ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. After years of work and consultation, the Matarenka Water Plan now finds itself in the NT Supreme Court, with the Environment Centre seeking to have it scrapped.
Essentially, what we'll be asking the Supreme Court to rule is that the Matarenka Water Allocation Plan, which was declared at the end of last year and allocates something like 62 billion litres of water a year from an aquifer that sustains Matarenka Hot Springs and the Roper River, we want that to be declared invalid.
Now, that court case is now underway, so you'll be getting an update on proceedings in just a moment. And why did the Weather Bureau's new website cost nearly $100 million? The Bureau's new boss will be on the Country Hour before 1:30. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. And g'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. First up this afternoon, I can tell you the Northern Territory's largest banana farm has suffered some damage from Cyclone Fina on the weekend. Now, this farm is located at Lambles Lagoon, and it normally supplies about 100% of the top end's banana needs. The farm manager out there says the Territory will need to import bananas from Queensland for quite a few months until his farm can get back into full production. To learn more, I went out to the farm earlier this morning.
G'day, I'm Mark Smith. I'm farm manager here at Darwin Fruit Farms, part of Premier Fresh Australia in the Northern Territory.
Tell us about the weekend, Cyclone Fina. What happened here?
Well, it was obviously pretty anxious waiting, you know, the lead up to the cyclone coming. So we were pretty well prepared. We got everyone working pretty hard to make sure things were prepared. We knocked quite a few leaves off some of the bays that we thought would help, and less wind resistance, therefore getting those plants not knocked around as much. But yeah, obviously it's just an anxious wait, and you have to wait and see till it's all over, come out and see what actually happened.
And so here we are at the plantation. What's your assessment of the damage?
I think it's probably better than I thought in some bays. Anything without any fruit hanging up lasted pretty well. You know, obviously you've got 40 kilos hanging around your neck, you're going to fall over a little bit easier than if you haven't. But some of these bays, like the one we're standing out here now, it's pretty well, like 40% of those plants are over. And I'd say we've definitely lost 40% plus of our fruit that we can harvest.
Yeah, where we're standing, there's banana trees over, and the bunches that were in their blue bags are on the ground. Are they salvageable at all, that fruit?
No. There's a couple of reasons why. I mean, you know, they've been over too long, so they haven't been fed properly, and the sunburn, and you don't want them, you don't want to harvest anything that's been in sort of runoff water either. So, yeah, you've only got a very short time to pick up what you can. And we did come out a bit earlier before the cyclone, and we filled up our harvest trailers. So we just had...
You picked as much as you could beforehand.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we went out there and filled up everything we could, and proved to be pretty beneficial to do that, and also beneficial to knock some of the leaves off those younger bays, so, you know, limited the wind resistance and cop as much.
There's a lot of trees down where we're standing, but say some of these other trees that I can see that are standing, but their leaves have... kind of in tatters. Do they have a future?
Yes, 100%. I mean, obviously, if you stress a banana plant that badly, it's going to compromise in the size of the bunch that comes out, especially anything that's got, you know, in a bunch initiation or is just about to throw a bunch. They're usually smaller. But
you'll leave them up and get some fruit off them?
Yeah, for sure. We'll be able to cut. And if they haven't rolled out of the ground, like that one's rolled out of the ground, so that's not as good. But the ones that have just snapped off, you know, roll out, but snap off, we can cut them off and just work on that follower to fill it. It's just going to take time, that's all. And we're going to have to assess actually which bays is worth saving and which aren't, you know. So I'd say we're probably going to lose, I'd say 40% of what's on the ground.
So this is the Northern Territory's largest banana farm that supplies nearly 100% of the top end's banana needs. What's the damage here going to mean to consumers?
Oh, it means that we're going to have to access fruit from our other farms in North Queensland to supply locally until we can get back up on track. And it just takes a bit of time. Obviously, we can't plant everything at once to try and get the numbers up, because we'd pick everything at once and then have nothing. We have to be pretty...
You have to stage your planting.
Yeah, we have to stagger the planting so we do spread our harvest over the year if we can. And that's the biggest thing. We will try and up it a little bit more if we can, if the plants are available. Tissue culture plants, you really should order them 12 months in advance. So whether we can get extra plants, I don't know yet.
When are you expecting to be picking fruit again?
Well, we picked this week. Yesterday we picked.
Right.
What we could was not much at all. And the stuff we picked on just before the cyclone, we processed. So I've got a 26 pallets coming from our North Queensland farm.
All right, so the Queensland bananas are on their way already.
They will, yeah. We've got a contract with the chain stores, and we want to make sure that we've got enough fruit for the local people. It's not going to be as good because they're Queensland bananas, obviously.
But a few extra Ks on them.
Yeah, and we'll just have to go from there. Look, it's going to be hard. I think for 3 weeks, next 3 weeks, we're going to sort of be wholly and solely reliant on Queensland fruit, but after that we'll have to, I'd say it'd be 80% fruit from Queensland and fill up what we can.
Rightio. Yeah. So when would you hope to be pumping out commercial quantities again from this farm?
Oh, look, as I said, in 3 months I reckon we'll have, you know, we'll be supplying fruit from here, but it won't be 100% local.
Mm.
You know, we needed all these bananas to actually supply locally, and that's what we're working on. So it's going to be eventually we'll get back to, you know, as close to 100% supply locally as we can. But it's going to be a staggered journey, I suppose. It's going to have to get fruit, and we'll lessen the fruit from Queensland as we get more fruit here.
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, it's hard to say, put a number on it, but look, I'd say it's going to be at least 8 months before we can actually supply.
So you're back to full production for the farm.
Yeah. At least, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, probably, well, it's still going to be a bit longer than that, because it really takes us about 8 months before we can harvest a bunch from planting. We have got a lot of young stuff in there, which is good, but it'll be up and down. You know, we'll have peaks and troughs as normal until we can get more in the ground and get a consistent supply going. It is devastating, and it's heartbreaking to see all your hard work on the ground. But honestly, if you're growing bananas in anywhere in the tropics in Australia, you're going to have to expect to get blown over now and then. You know, it's just part of it. And you can't get away from it.
Thanks for sharing time for our show. I really appreciate it.
No worries, does the
audience.
Yeah. No worries, Matt. All good. Good to see you come out and give a bit of care about looking after the bananas. It's good to hear. It's a staple for everyone in Darwin, really.
We love our bananas.
Yeah.
Too right.
Oh, Catchman, Gove, everywhere else as well. So it's all good. So we want to get back into full production as quick as possible. It's better for us and it's better for the territory.
That is Mark Smith, who's the farm manager for Darwin Fruit Farms in Lambles Lagoon. That is the Northern Territory's biggest, and let's face it, it really is the only major commercial banana farm in the NT, and it has suffered some damage. What did Mark tell us? They've lost about 40%, more than 40% of the fruit, and probably take more than 8 months to get back into full production. Hopefully, consumers, you won't notice much of a difference when you go to your local supermarket. The Queensland bananas are on their way, so there'll be bananas there to be enjoyed. They just haven't come from around the corner at Lambles Lagoon. They've come from a bit further afield.
Andrew Dalgleish, Foxalicious Fruit, just out of Katherine. When I get a spare moment on the tractor, I like listening to Matt and the team on the Country Hour.
And out at Lambles Lagoon, the lights are on. The power actually never went out at all during Cyclone Fina out there at Lambles Lagoon. I trust you're well at your place this afternoon. Power and Water says in the last 24 hours, thousands of homes and businesses have had their power restored, but there's still about 5,000 places without power in the greater Darwin region and also on the Tiwi Islands. Power and Water Corp's core operations manager, Michael Besselink, he was on ABC Radio earlier, and here's his update for today.
We're at a point now where we've got about 14,900 customers restored, so there's still 5,000 customers without power, which we're working on. So we're also, it's actually when we're talking about rural, but we're also working in some of the communities. As you know, Warramyanga was badly hit. We have got power back to the majority of Warramyanga now. There are some areas where, premises have been damaged through trees and those sorts of things, and they're sort of, you know, one by one being restored. But those things are happening. In the rural area, we have quite a number of people out in the rural areas working on those as well. So they're actually coming back in. But like today, we're looking at the crews actually are working in Nimaluk Road, Ludmilla, Lee Point Road, Berrima, Jingley, East Arm and Alloa at the moment to work through. But there's a couple of rather complex jobs, and those complex jobs are ones where we've actually either got poles damaged, you know, multiple bays of wires on the ground and things like that. But Lee Point Road at the Buffalo Creek end, Jingley, Wellington Parade, Alloa, Stewart Highway, Berrima near JB Hi-Fi, Nimaluk Drive, Ludmilla, Stewart Highway near the Robbie Robbins Reserve, Kennedy Road, Humpty Doo, Dundee Beach and Gunpoint have got some fairly large restoration activities required.
Your message for people today, I guess.
Look, it's the same as I suppose it's been. Please be safe when you look around. There is still infrastructure that's pretty badly damaged, and just don't go anywhere near it. We are working as hard as we can to get these things happening. At the moment, we have around about 40 field crews, which is about 120 people conducting those repairs and whatever. We've got a lot of contractors working with us, specialised people doing tree cutting near the power lines and that sort of stuff. We continue to appreciate the patience of our Northern Territorians. I know it's going to wear thin.
Yeah.
You know, these things are there, and you know, electricity is an essential service, and we are working as hard as we can to get it back to everybody.
That is Power and Waters. Michael Besserling speaking to Adam Steer this morning. It is 18 to 1, and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Now, after years of work and consultation, the Mataranka Water Plan now finds itself in the NT Supreme Court, with the Environment Centre seeking to have the plan scrapped. What is being said in the courtroom today? I'll be taking you there next. Stick around. Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. The Environment Centre NT is in the Supreme Court today seeking to have the Mataranka Water Plan ruled invalid. Now, this plan was officially declared late last year by the Territory Government. Here's just a little reminder of what the Water Minister, Joshua Burgoyne, said on the Country Hour when announcing that plan.
The Mataranka Water Allocation Plan, it covers some 9,000 square kilometres and comprises essentially three management zones, North Mataranka, South Mataranka and Larimer. So what we're obviously announcing today is of that 32 million megalitres that's available there, the aquifer, there will be a sustainable yield of 62,474 megalitres per year. Now what that means is that in the North Mataranka area, where you have Bitter Springs, where you have a lot of these sensitive environmental flows, the water's fully allocated. If you were to go today and apply for a licence to the independent water controller, he'd turn around, look at this plan and say, sorry, no more water. We know that in Larimer, much further south, there is room for water allocation and for industry.
So that's the Water Minister speaking to us in December last year. The Environment Centre, represented by the Environmental Defender's Office, is in court today arguing the Minister did not have adequate information and evidence upon which to base his decision. Here's the Environment Centre's Kirsty Howie speaking to Rick Hind just prior to proceedings getting underway in the Supreme Court.
We have a really important case that is happening. It's being heard finally, and essentially what we'll be asking the Supreme Court to rule is that the Mataranka Water Allocation Plan, which was declared at the end of last year and allocates something like 62 billion litres of water a year from an aquifer that sustains Mataranka Hot Springs and the Roper River. We want that to be declared invalid.
And is there any real risk to the hot springs from this water allocation? What is that risk?
Well, look, we've been hearing from communities in Mataranka, Jukmingan and along the Roper that they're already seeing the impacts of existing extraction on the springs and on the river. And our science, our independent advice and communities are telling us that, increasing rates of extraction from the aquifer will have negative impacts on these iconic places that so many people, not just here in the Territory, but globally, love. And that's our fear, and we want to stop that from happening.
Kirsty Howie from the Environment Centre NT speaking to Rick Hind earlier. James Elton from ABC News has been in the Supreme Court today. James, what's been happening?
Well, Matt, as you say, this is a very significant case for potentially how water planning is done in the Northern Territory going forward. One of the most important arguments that we've been hearing from the plaintiff side so far, so that is the Environment Centre's side of things, is they're saying that in the original water plan that was signed by Minister Burgoyne, it effectively makes a small allocation, or what's known as a nominal allocation, for the environment within the water plan. But then it says, don't worry too much, because there's all of the rest of the water, all the leftover water is there for the environment. Mm. So there is water available to keep the groundwater dependent ecosystems healthy. What the plaintiff is saying is that's not good enough. What the Act actually requires is that the minister should have done a bigger, a more substantive allocation for the environment and locked that in the plan, so that there would always be a set figure that is determined to be enough to keep the Roper flowing and to keep the groundwater-dependent ecosystems around Bitter Springs there. So in many ways, it's a very technical argument about what the different words in the Water Act mean and whether Minister Burgoyne interpreted them correctly in making this plan.
Right. So this is all around that little quirk in the Water Act where, 62,000 odd megalitres has been deemed by the government sustainable to take out of that aquifer and the rest goes to the environment. But within that sustainable yield, there's a little mention of water for the environment and a lot of the arguments centred around that little quirk.
That's exactly right. So what the plaintiff is saying is that they actually should have determined a complete figure for the environment and put all of that within the estimated sustainable yield, rather than saying, all right, we can take this amount out and basically say we leave the rest for the environment. To put it in the words of the barrister representing the Environment Centre, he says that water is essentially left unprotected, uncontrolled, and it's at the mercy of future decisions down the track. So that's their interpretation. It's important to say we have not yet heard from the barristers representing the government on this, representing the minister. That'll be coming after lunch, and no doubt they'll have a very different interpretation. But much of this goes down to semantics and the meanings of phrases. One of the other issues in this case is this water plan only deals with groundwater. That is the water from the aquifer. And the plaintiff is saying that's actually not lawful either. They think that the Water Act requires the minister to, would have required the minister to have made a plan that deals with both surface water and groundwater together if it's in the same geographic region. And that, again, is going to come down to really semantic technical arguments about the meanings of words. The lawyers have already started busting out the Latin, Matt, and they lose me. They lose me at that point.
Is this going just for one day? What's the story from here on?
It is going just for one day.
Right.
So the lawyers have done a lot of work in the background leading up to this. The judge has an enormous volume of written material, as you might expect, to read through. And actually, it's all been very civil. The lawyers keep saying, you know, we don't disagree about this, we don't disagree about that. The merits of the minister's decision are not really in question here. This isn't a qualitative argument about whether the minister put enough water in the plan for the environment or not. It's really about, the technical meanings of words and the process by which the plan was derived. So all of it should be heard today, but then we may well have a fair bit of time to wait for the judge to absorb all of this extremely dense technical information and then arrive at a decision.
Understood. Thank you so much for running us through that, James. Really appreciate it. And I'll let you get back into the courtroom.
Thanks very much.
James Elton from ABC News. You'll see more on the TV tonight, I am sure. Across the Territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, you'll hear from the new boss of the Bureau of Meteorology.
Charles Vaughan here, Australian Cattle Enterprises and Charles Vaughan Veterinary Services. I'm here today at Berrima Export Yards, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
The new boss of the Weather Bureau says it was miscommunication that led to the news this week that the cost of redesigning the new bomb website blew out from $4 million to $96.5 million for that new website. Dr. Stuart Minchin says a big portion of that money has been spent on a backup supercomputer, which the Bureau hopes will ensure the website is more secure against hackers.
Originally, the Bureau was asked what the design costs for the website front end were, which was the $4 million figure. But the website front end, if you like, is just the tip of the iceberg. Underlying that is a huge system that takes tens of thousands of instruments across the Australian region, satellite imagery, brings that into a supercomputer where the modelling is done out to production systems in order to make the forecast. And the entire system had to be replaced after a hacking incident in 2015. So, yeah, the total cost of the website includes all of that back end, not just the front end.
When did you become aware of the true total figure of $96.5 million?
Well, look, I've only been in the Bureau for 2 weeks, and as soon as I started looking into this issue. It's been quite open within the Bureau, the cost of this this website. This is part of a larger program.
So if it's been open within the Bureau, why wasn't it communicated more widely? I mean, we can talk about front end and so on, but common sense would say, how much is this whole redesign, rebooting of the website cost? It's 96.5.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think there was perhaps a communication error made at the time where the exact question that was asked by the journalist at the time, which was about the website design costs, was answered rather than a more holistic answer. I can commit that on taking the helm of the Bureau, I wanted to make that as transparent as possible and be open and honest with the Australian people.
Was the minister informed of the 96.5 figure or the full figure at an earlier time, or was that only in the past week when it came out in the media?
Well, look, as I mentioned, this is part of a larger program of work that was actually signed off by Cabinet back in 2017 and has repeatedly been part of the budget updates. So the website component is about 10% of a much larger program of replacing all of the Bureau's back-end systems and processes. And that's been visible to government all the way through.
Stuart Minchin, let me read you a bit, some comments from Brad Perry. He's the Chief Executive of Grain Producers SA. He's based on Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. He's saying with that kind of expenditure, something like Doppler radar on Eyre Peninsula, where there's a black hole for that kind of technology, would have been much better spend. Do you agree the money could have been better spent?
Well, look, I think we've got to look back at the hacking incident in 2015, which really opened up the threat that hackers could take down the entire Bureau system. Imagine if we were facing a situation like Tropical Cyclone Fina and we were unable to issue a weather forecast for a week or 2 weeks period because hackers had got into our network. So this was a really urgent need to address what was a very insecure...
It's urgent, but it's taken 10 years to fix it by the sounds of that timeline.
And it's a massive project. Look, please don't be... don't misunderstand the size of this. We had to install a backup supercomputer. This is a massive investment and a huge amount of technical work.
So for the past 10 years, has the weather forecasting capabilities, has that been vulnerable until this has all been put together?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's been, progressively, this has been protected and improved, and it's really only with the latest update of the website that the front end, the web access, has actually been updated to more secure platform.
Just finally, how important is the task of rebuilding trust between the Bureau and the public at the start of your term now?
Look, I'm coming into the Bureau. I think the Bureau is a fantastic institution full of incredibly dedicated people, dedicated to serving the Australian community. I think the Australian community understands that at times of crisis, when we're standing next to them, Tropical Cyclone Fina and other emergencies. This website issue has clearly damaged some of that trust, but I hope to regain that through being open, honest and working diligently to apply remedies to that process.
That is Dr. Stuart Minchin, who's the new Chief Executive and Director of Meteorology of the Bureau of Meteorology. He was speaking to Sally Sara on RN Breakfast this morning. On the text line, someone here says, I can't see how it could cost even $5 million to build a website, let alone change a really good, useful website into one that's totally useless. I hope it won't cost us another $100 million to make a new website that actually works. Someone else here, Dave in Palmerston, says, come on, who really wants to hack that new bomb website unless they want to have a good laugh? And Davo says, no, sorry, Roger says, Matt, the Weather Bureau should be congratulated for their accurate prediction of Cyclone Fina's path. Could you please ask the Bureau how much worse the damage would have been if it had taken a similar path to that of Marcus back in 2018? Good question, Roger. I'll put that to the Bureau in 5 minutes' time. See you then.
G'day, my name's Isabel Heffernan and I'm a business analyst based at Amundi Station. So there's more than just running cattle and chasing cows around. There's a lot going on behind the scenes in the office. There's always an excuse to get onto Excel and make some data-driven decisions. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. One of our big stories last week was about the Northern Territory Aviation Company, HM Air, selling its entire fleet of R-22 mustering helicopters. Who bought all those choppers? You'll hear from that company before 1:30. And we are hearing from you this afternoon, 0487 99 1057. Jamie says, at the Hidden Valley dumping green waste, it's great. There's no weights, there's heaps of room. What's the Chief Minister going on about, says Jamie. Someone else here is wondering why there's a weather radar at Giles. Someone else wants to know how many Tennant Creek radars you could get for $100 million. And earlier on, we were talking about the Mataranka Water Plan ending up in the NT Supreme Court. Davo says, it's incredible that the impacts of extraction are so evident on the Roper River, given the groundwater is on average higher now than when extraction began. And it's much higher than it was in the 1970s. So simply incredible in the truest sense of the word. This court challenge, says Davo, is not technical, it is semantic. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
Cyclone Fina, where's it at the moment?
Sitting over the Kimberleys, a little bit west of Wyndham. It's crossed the coast. It's only a Category 1 at the moment. So it's weakened off and it is continuing to weaken. There is still a band coming down, sort of just near Wadair and into the northwest Gregory a little bit. But generally, most of the weather's now on the WA side of the border. Having said that, we do have a little shower. So into these things, you can get these little spidery sort of lines of showers, and that's probably what these are over the western top end. But so there's a few showers going up through there, but it's generally over the Kimberley. It's moving really slowly. It's probably dumping a lot of rain where it is.
And there's not many rain gauges in that part of Australia.
No, unfortunately. And we do have that severe weather warning out as well for there. So for the bands, the heavy rainfall.
Yeah. All right, then. And here in the Northern Territory, well, tell us about Central Australia. The Alice Springs radar's lighting up this afternoon.
Yeah, we've got a lot of storms up through Windamoo Way and through the Lasser District, and a few up in the far southwest, southeast corner of the Barkly. There's been a little bit of rain down through there. There's been sort of about 5 to 10 mils across the area to 9 a.m. But we are seeing those storms. Again, we've got to get one in the rain gauge to tell us exactly how much we're getting out of them. But we are looking at those showers and storms continuing. They could be a little bit gusty, and particularly tomorrow the risk of the gusts increases. And then as we go through Friday, into Friday, the heavy rainfall as well, just from those storms and also the wind gusts. So it's going to be sort of maybe a little bit wet and windy down south, but not quite what we saw due to the cyclone in the north, but it's still got potential for those gusty storms.
Well, what was it, 2-3 weeks ago, that big storm swept through Central Australia and people around Tea Tree copped 137-kilometre winds, didn't they?
Yeah, we've had some very big gusts come through in the last few, over the last couple of months. We've just seen those storms that do produce those damaging wind gusts, but probably the difference between the cyclones and the storms is the area that the covers, so you may see the storm go past, but you may not to experience the damage of it.
There is still a severe heatwave warning in place for the Barkly, Simpson, Lassiter and Tanami districts. How long are you expecting that to last for?
Well, with the showers and storms down south picking up, it is on the easing trend. We do still have very hot conditions through the Barkly through to Thursday in the Carpentaria district, but it's gradually sort of contracting northwards, and by the time we get to the weekend, we do have an increase in showers and storms across the north. We got a number of little troughs coming through, and that's what's helping to kick up these storms. Then the more major one comes through on the weekend, and that starts clearing the southern parts of the territory out, but and is also going to help to get rid of the final sort of over 40s sort of around that sort of nook away.
Okay, and in the north, there's still a flood watch in place for the Fitzmaurice and Moyle rivers, but it's all on an easing trend there. What's now that the cyclone has left the Northern Territory, I guess when can we expect some potential follow-up rain?
Well, we have the next few days are going to get a little bit quieter. If you go into the Carpentaria and the Barkly, we do have to a mid-level ridge. You get ridges down the surface, you get them up through the atmosphere, and that's just keeping that area a little bit quieter. But the chances of that follow-up rain increases on the weekend. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, if you're in the top end, or Monday more if you're top end, Saturday, Sunday, sort of south, north of probably about Elliott. And then it just depends on how far north this really dry surge pushes as to what happens over the top end after that. But at the moment, we're looking at certainly some follow-up rain for the north once we get towards the weekend.
Anything else we should be aware of this afternoon?
No, just keep an ear out for those warnings. Yeah, the flood watch is on its way, so everything's easing, but if you're in Central Australia, just keeping an ear out for any storms that are put out, any warnings put out for those storms.
Okay, thanks so much for your time this afternoon,
that's
Sally. Okay. Appreciate it.
That's okay.
It's 11 past one on the Country Hour. Shout out to all communities in the top end who are still cleaning up after FINA. I trust you are well. Got a text here from John saying, Matt, any news on when the NBN might be back up and running? I haven't heard a thing. Producer Fiona, are we able to maybe make a few phone calls and try and find an answer there for John? And I'm sure plenty of others.
Corbin Middlemass here. This summer is all about the Ashes. To stay across every angle, join me and Ed Cowan on ABC Cricket Podcast, Monday and Friday and after every day of play. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, if you've been listening to the Country Hour over the last week or so, you know the live export industry had this mad dash before the cyclone. Big rush to get cattle, thousands of them, off the floodplains before that cyclone arrived and before the big rains came as well. Nick Verica from Road Trains of Australia, he played a big role in all of that. And he says they're still sort of working out how cattle regions have fared after that event?
We're meant to be moving a lot more this week, but because of the cyclone, obviously cyclones bring rain. So there was a few people scrambling just so that we could get cattle out before the cyclone. So we lifted a lot of cattle out of Litchfield Station and out of the Bell Station on Friday. So we shifted between the two places, like 32 trucks, 32 loads out of there. So, yeah, we shifted about the best part of 5,500 to 6,000 just on Friday off the floodplain. So there's more ahead, more floodplain ahead, but it just depends on the road conditions now because out the Arnhem Highway direction towards the other properties on the floodplain, they had up best part of 400 mils in some of those places, so it'll just be a bit of a wait and see.
It's how much of that fleet did it take up to be able to meet that requirement in the top end?
Yeah, well, I had the whole Territory fleet run that job on Friday, so, yeah, it just had the ability to do it, which made life easier. Certainly a busy day.
When are you expecting to get a bit of an idea of the impacts the storm has had on the roads?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of floodways full of water. There is a lot of water around, and then it's, you know, getting onto all the stations it's a dirt road, so... probably in the next day or two, we'll sort of get a bit of understanding of what's going on. I've obviously been sidetracked with my own dealing with the cleanup at home. So, today I'll get a better handle on what's actually happening out there.
And finally, you sort of mentioned a little bit what's left for the year for RTA. What is next as we sort of look at wrapping up 2025?
Yeah, so we've got obviously when you bring cattle into town, they're for a boat. So we've got boats tomorrow, one later in the week. We've got probably got another 10 or 12,000 head to bring in on the floodplain. And then I've got a big lift out of Queensland in about the 10th. I've got about 100 decks to get out of Cloncurry. So it's still good enough to keep everyone busy. But, yeah, it'll sort of, as of about the 10th of December, we'll start winding down.
That is Nick Verica, who's the NT Manager of Road Trains of Australia, speaking to Charles Geary. It's been a super busy time for the live cattle trade and for the trucking industry. We're joined this afternoon by Peter Dummett, who's the Chief Executive of the Darwin Port. The port was closed for a while there as the cyclone approached, but what's the story out there now this afternoon, Pete?
Yeah, g'day, Matt. Hello, listeners. Just arrived back in the office this afternoon, having, as I said to you when we spoke on Friday, was interstate at the time. So cyclone's been and gone. We are back in full operations now, which is great. Fortunately, we sustained very little damage to port infrastructure and our fittings and the like. So that was good. That was assessed on the Sunday morning post-cyclone. Then yesterday we managed to get pilot boats out and they did an on-water assessment, looking at things like hazards in berth pockets and shipping channels, which identified no real issues. We opened the port yesterday at 11 a.m. Initially for barge operators that had vacated the port. They were allowed to come back in. Obviously, they were pretty keen to get back in and start getting supplies and equipment out to the communities, the Tiwi Islands and other communities that were hit pretty hard by the cyclone.
All right, so the port is back in business, and I see our good friend the Ardmore Sea Wolf is up against the wharf this afternoon. So this is the fuel tanker.
Yeah, that was the one we brought in late on Friday to discharge some diesel. It's back in now and it's going to discharge whatever diesel's left and fill up the tanks at the Vopak bulk liquids terminal.
Yeah, right. Do you know how much diesel it managed to get into the Northern Territory in that sort of mad rush there on Friday?
I don't know that, Matt. Yeah. No. As I said, we got the thing in... had it tied up alongside and it was the last vessel to go before we closed the port at 9 p.m. on Friday evening. So, to be able to get up and running again so quickly, that's an absolute credit, firstly, to my team who managed the whole process throughout the weekend, but also to the port users who, they take this seriously as well. As I sort of say to my team and a few people that asked the question, why do we start early? Why do we go to so much detail? And it's the old 5 P's situation, and that's proper preparation. So did all of that, and that makes it really easy to push the button and get back into operations. Obviously, we've still got a number of things we've got to do with, you know, tarpaulins, canopies that were taken down, and fenders and other bits and pieces that were taken out of the water. But we're operational now, which is the important thing. Most importantly, nobody was injured. I understand that's the situation for pretty well the whole of the territory in relation to the cyclone, which is great news. As I was coming from the airport, lots of trees down, and I'm not sure whether I'm looking forward to going back to my place this afternoon. I haven't been there yet, but
fingers crossed for you, Pete.
Yeah,
fingers crossed.
Yeah, no, one of my colleagues did a drive-by yesterday and sent me a bunch of photos and said it looks pretty good from the outside, so that's a good start.
Hey, just quickly, we heard from a cattle exporter yesterday who talked about how there'd been some delays to shipping for obvious reasons, and his hopes were that there wouldn't be any port conjecture over the next few days. What's it looking like for the live cattle trade?
Really good question, Matt, and I haven't even had a look at the schedule since I got back.
I've got here that the Ganado Express is on East Arm Wharf right now. But my understanding was it wasn't meant to be loaded till.
I seriously have not had a look. I said straight from the airport, straight to my office. So, I really don't know. Just trying to have a quick look now as we speak.
That's okay. Well, at the moment, the port calendar suggests it's going out tomorrow. So maybe it is there, getting ready to be loaded up with a few.
It could well be.
Which, if is the case, is a pretty good outcome, I would have thought, for those cattle.
And that's really a credit to the industry. If they're able to get trucks moving that quickly, that's a great outcome.
Beauty. Well, thanks so much for your time this afternoon. Is there anything else that you think our audience needs to know about Darwin Port at the moment?
No, not really, Matt. It's really just getting back to normal now. As I said, all our stakeholders, all our staff, I really credit all of them for what we were able to achieve in very quick time, and that's the shutdown and the safe restart. So they should all give themselves a great pat on the back.
Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you.
That is Peter Dummett, the Chief Executive of the Darwin Port. It's 20 past one, and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Some interesting news over in Western Australia. Fishermen have made a very interesting discovery off the coast just north of Perth. I'm joined in the studio by Fiona Broom. What did these fishos find?
Matt, they have discovered half a ton of cocaine.
Right.
Floating off Western Australia's coast. And the chief officer of an international livestock carrier is among four men who've been charged following that discovery. So the fishers discovered this large package, or kind of series of packages, tied to a floating drum. They found that about 30K offshore, sort of north of Perth. So officers from WA Police and the AFP, they've collected the bundle. They reckon it was about 525 kilograms of cocaine with a street value of, they say, more than $170 million. So police are alleging the drugs were dumped overboard while the livestock carrier was making its way to Fremantle Harbour. Mm-hmm. And the vessel's chief officer has been charged with attempting to import a commercial quantity of cocaine, Matt. There is more on that story up on the ABC News website now if you just search ABC and cocaine.
And live export. Not really the story the live export trades after. And just while you're here, because you are our bird flu correspondent, you've got some bird flu news.
I have got some bird flu news. Testing has confirmed the H5 avian influenza has been discovered present in an Australian territory. So samples were collected from some southern elephant seals over on Heard Island, which is a sub-Antarctic Australian external territory. And they were recently sent to the mainland for testing. Last week, I think they reached the mainland.
Yeah, I remember. I remember.
Yeah. So this is, Matt, the first recorded detection of H5 bird flu on Australian territory. But as Heard Island is more than 4,000 kilometres southwest of Perth, biosecurity authorities say the detection doesn't substantially increase the risk to Australia, mainland Australia, from current levels.
You've got more chance of seeing cocaine floating in the ocean than going to Heard Island. Yeah. Thank you for the update.
New from ABC Books.
The Dark Prince of Melbourne by Ian W. Shaw on the notorious Squizzy Taylor, and Outback Astronomer by Trevor Barry, the miner whose passion took him to NASA. Both out now from bookshops and online.
One of our big stories last week was about the Northern Territory-based aviation company, HM Air, formerly known as Helimuster NT, buying Alice Springs helicopters and also selling off its entire fleet of R-22 helicopters. If you've been wondering who bought all of those mustering choppers, as well as the hangar and base at Victoria River Downs Cattle Station, well, it's Sam Warden, who owns Ord Valley Helicopters in Kununurra. He spoke to Georgia Hargreaves about the purchase.
The opportunity arose earlier in the year to buy the Robertson fleet from Helimuster as they diversified and moved into other avenues of aviation. Yeah, and we sort of took on the bulk of their mustering there in the VRD area, and all the pilots came over with it, and, yeah, obviously that VRD base came over as well. I can't stress enough how grateful I am for the, you know, the help and support that Sam and Georgie Chisholm offered us going through, and even with our previous purchase, which is we're still pretty new to in Kununurra, Jock and Haley were great as well. So it's been, I mean, business is usually quite hard, but yeah, these transitions have been really smooth. We've been supported really well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going well. If you are expanding, then, as you say, how big is your fleet now if you've just added another 14 machines?
Somewhere would be 25, 22s and a 44.
And what are your plans now?
My plans are to make sure we have the right people within the business to coordinate things safely and, yeah, hopefully stay on top of everything and provide a service that is predominantly focused on the pastoral industry and cattle, yeah, and not much else really. So,
and can you tell us a bit about how Ord Valley Helicopters came to be? Because it looks like it's a new business, but you've obviously been in the game a long time. So how did you get here?
The business in Kununurra it's a hard one. We didn't really buy the business. We just sort of, we took over the mustering side of a business in Kununurra. But that business has changed hands and will probably continue to change hands quite frequently. It's just how that industry sort of works. But when we took it on, you know, it had changed names, it had changed structures, it had changed operators. It had changed so much in the last 15 years that there was nothing really, like it wasn't really holding a legacy, so to speak. So, you know, I operated out of Broome before that under Western Airwork, and that's still our, you know, I still own Western Airwork and we still operate under that. And but when I sort of pack up from Kununurra and move on, whenever that might be, I think it's better having a business that can stay with Kununurra and stay with the area. So we rebranded and came up with Ord Valley Helicopters, and hopefully when the time comes for us to move on, that's something that we can leave there and not have to take the approval of a name elsewhere. It'll stay in Kununurra.
That's Sam Warden from Ord Valley Helicopters, who's just picked up a whole fleet of R-22s. He was speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. It's time now in the Country Hour to head to the sale yards of all the latest prices out of Roma. Here's David Friend.
numbers increased to 9,556 head at Roma. All the regular buyers attending and active. An exceptional lineup of quality cattle on offer from the regular supply area as well as New South Wales. The market very solid to Dura. At the time of this interim report, yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos, sold from 380 to 622 cents a kilo to restockers. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos made to 614 to average 571 cents a kilo to restockers. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos topped at 582 cents a kilo to restockers and 540 cents to lot feeders. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos sold from 480 to 532 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Yearling steers over 480 kilos to 458 to processors. Grama steers 400 to 500 kilos to 450 cents a kilo to processors. Grama steers 600 to 750 kilos sold from 448 to 484 cents a kilo to processors, and bulls over 600 kilos to 380. This has been David Frem from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Thank you for that, David. Earlier on, I got a text from John wanting some news on when the NBN might be back up and running. Well, a big thanks to NBN and to Nicole, who have sent through this update to the Country House. I hope this helps. It says there remains about 285 services unable to access the NBN network in and around Livingston, Noonamah, Humpty Doo, Hughes, Berry Springs, Southport and Fly Creek. I can also confirm that generators have been deployed to support NBN network connectivity in the Howard Springs region. However, services remain offline. Technicians are now on site and are working to restore the affected NBN services as a priority. Thank you to the NBN for that update. So I hope that helps, John, and I hope everyone in the top end is doing well as we clean up after Cyclone Fina. More stories throughout the afternoon with Jess Ong. And I hope you can tune in tomorrow, because the Caring for Country Song Competition, the winners will be announced on this program tomorrow. It's now become almost a national competition. Last year it was just the NT. This year they've allowed the Queenslanders and the West Aussies to participate as well. So has the Territory managed to win? You'll find out tomorrow. Keep it rural.